This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, the 30th of April, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. The Interior Department outlines a plan to open millions of acres of federal waters for offshore oil and natural gas drilling. Nearly a million people take to the streets of Istanbul to stop the candidacy of a contender they say wants an Islamic state. And the mothers of Plaza de Mayo celebrate 30 years of fighting for justice. We'll hear from Buenos Aires. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to hear an appeal by two Guantanamo Bay detainees who sought to challenge the legitimacy of the military tribunals created by the Military Commissions Act. The majority ruled that the military trial must first occur before the process can be subject to an appeal. One of the detainees, Salem Hamdan, won a Supreme Court challenge last year that struck down the old system used to try prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. The Supreme Court ruled it was a violation of U.S. and international law. Congress then passed the Military Commissions Act, thereby giving legal weight to a system that allows for aggressive interrogation methods, the use of secret evidence, and denies a prisoner the right to challenge his detention in a civilian court. Today's ruling is the second time this month that the Supreme Court has sided with the Bush administration on the issue of military tribunals. Israel's War Commission released a report today severely criticizing the Israeli Prime Minister's decision to go to war against Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon last summer. Jackson Ellers reports on the reaction from Beirut.
The commission stated in its 232-page report that Prime Minister Olmert, quote, made up his mind hastily and accused him of, quote, a serious failure in exercising judgment, responsibility, and prudence in the attack against Hezbollah in Lebanon last summer. The report also questioned Olmert's assessment that the Israeli military could rescue two soldiers captured by Hezbollah in a cross-border raid on July 12th of last year. In Lebanon's capital, Beirut, discussion on the streets focused more on what was missing in the report.
The criticism that's being directed against Prime Minister Olmert and Israel has been that of tactic and not that of policy.
Rania Masri, a professor of economics at Balaman University in Lebanon, Masri said the report made no mention of the larger discussion questioning the legality of the Israeli aggression. The Israeli military offensive claimed 1,200 Lebanese lives and destroyed much of Lebanon's infrastructure. Meanwhile, an Israeli radio poll said 69% of the Israeli public believed Olmert should quit the government, but sources close to Olmert say he has no plans to resign. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Sri Lanka's Tamil Tiger rebels have launched another airstrike, this time on a fuel depot near the capital city. Panea Manikavasagam has more.
Officials said 11 rebels were killed in clashes between government forces and the Tamil guerrillas after rebel planes bombed military fuel storage facilities around 2 a.m. on Sunday. The night sky lit up with anti-aircraft fire and the city plunged into darkness. Cricket fans watching the World Cup finals between Sri Lanka and Australia panicked and ran for cover. It was the third time in a month that the rebels have used light aircraft to hit military targets. The government deployed supersonic jets to strike back at the rebels and vowed to destroy the rebels' air power. A rebel leader said that the latest attack in Colombo was in retaliation against the government's continuing air raids in the rebel territories in the north. As a result, Hong Kong carrier Cathay Pacific and Dubai-based Emirates have suspended all flights to Sri Lanka and the stock market crashed Monday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiya Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo today called on the military to help police curb political violence ahead of next month's midterm elections. Girly Linao reports.
The directive comes after a weekend of election-related attacks that killed three people, including a mayor of a northern Philippine city. The murders brought to 31 the number of people killed in almost 100 election-related violent incidents since January, according to the police. In her directive, President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo ordered the military to reinforce the police to stop election violence and move against groups using threats and intimidation. She also ordered the military and police to dismantle private armies and round up unauthorized firearms. Philippine voters head to the polls on May 14th to elect 12 senators, more than 200 congressional representatives, and some 17,000 local officials. Elections in the Philippines have traditionally been marred by violence, often due to intense political rivalry or allegations of fraud. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Linao in Manila.
Amnesty International today released its latest report card on human rights in China. The last 12 months have seen some significant changes, but Amnesty says it's not enough. FSRN's Elise Potaka has more from Beijing.
When China bid for the 2008 Olympic Games, it pledged to improve its record on human rights. But today, Amnesty International released a report which says China has a long way to go before it fulfills this promise. The report says that strike-hard policies which constrain activists, lawyers, journalists and human rights defenders are overshadowing progress in other areas. This year, China has moved to increase freedom for foreign press and to re-evaluate its use of the death penalty. But Amnesty says that while foreign media restrictions have loosened, controls on domestic media have increased, as has monitoring of the internet. And while use of the death penalty now has to be approved by the country's Supreme People's Court, Amnesty notes that this regulation has been ignored by local officials. While there's been no official comments from the Chinese government, at a recent press briefing, a foreign affairs spokesperson accused Amnesty of being biased against China. But Amnesty says its concerns are in line with the core principles of the Olympic Charter. In Beijing, I'm Elise Portaka for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration wants to expand offshore oil and natural gas drilling. Today, the Interior Department outlined a plan to lease 180 million acres of federal waters to oil and gas companies in the next 5 years. FSRN's Yame She has the story from Washington, D.C.
The administration proposes to sell 21 oil and gas exploration leases in the Gulf of Mexico and offshore from Alaska and Virginia. The Interior Department projects that those areas will produce 10 billion barrels of oil and 45 trillion cubic feet of natural gas over 40 years. Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne says those yields can reduce the nation's reliance on foreign energy.
10 billion barrels of oil are equal to the amount of oil imported from the Persian Gulf over a 10-year period. 45 trillion cubic feet of gas is enough to meet the natural gas needs of every residential customer in the United States for almost 10 years.
The plan allows for the first time drilling off the eastern shore of Virginia, home to several wildlife refuges. It's also an area dotted with islands, lagoons, and wetlands. Many of them have fragile ecological systems. The Washington Post reports that Virginia Democratic Governor Tim Kaine supports the drilling plan on the condition that no exploration will take place within 50 miles of Virginia's shoreline. The Interior Department has agreed to comply. But no drilling in that area can take place until Congress gives its permission. The Interior Department, therefore, does not expect drilling there before 2011. Areas in the Gulf of Mexico and offshore Alaska, however, are not under the congressional moratorium that covers Virginia shores. Therefore, the Interior Department plans to lease out some of those regions as early as July this year. Secretary Kempthorne says marine lives will be shielded from drilling activities by a 25-mile buffer zone. Environmentalists say the buffer zone is hardly any protection. Richard Charter is with the Defenders of Wildlife. He says oil spill spreads at a rate of 1 mile per hour on a dead still ocean surface, and much faster with the help of wind and waves.
What you're saying when you provide a 25-mile buffer zone is you'll have 25 hours, roughly one day, to put in place oil spill response equipment and, you know, cleanup and containment devices, which don't work very well anyway. At best, they clean up maybe 15 or 20% of the oil. So a 25-mile buffer zone is really a joke. It's not an assurance at all.
The Bristol Bay north of the Alaska Peninsula is included for lease sale under the plan. It is home to one of the world's largest salmon runs and endangered right whales. Kempthorne says the department will not issue any lease in that area until it can determine the impact on the right whales.
And so we need to undertake now an extensive examination to determine what is the science, what is the ability of this species to continue to be a vital part. We anticipate that that may take 3.5 years.
In addition to marine lives, Richard Charter of the Defenders of Wildlife says people who rely on fishery for a living or use the ocean waters for recreation will be victims of increased offshore drilling.
So if we're going to make this sacrifice, and it would be a sacrifice, we ought to do it in the context of improved fuel efficiency standards for cars, for example, which this administration has consistently blocked and continues to block. So the question is, are we at a point of desperation where we give up our value system as a nation and sacrifice these areas?
Congress had 60 days to impose a ban on drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and offshore Alaska. If it doesn't pass such a ban, the Interior Department will start leasing out federal waters to oil and gas companies this July. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
Almost a million people took to the streets in Istanbul Sunday in a demonstration opposing the presidential candidacy of Abdullah Gül, current foreign minister of the ruling pro-Islamic Justice and Development Party. The presidential election has become the climax point of the tension between the government and the secularist Kemalists, who accuse it of attempting to create an Islamic state. FSRN's Ezgi Sertaj reports.
Çalayan Square in Istanbul was washed with red and white with the Turkish flags yesterday. The demonstrators holding the flags were shouting chants against the government and some support the military that declared a memorandum on Friday night. The memorandum warned about two things: the upcoming second round of presidential elections and government's strict Islamic tendencies. Last week, replacing the celebration of the national fest of opening of assembly with a religious celebration was such an event that aroused many reactions. After the declaration by the military, the government spokesman Cemil Çiçek declared that it is not acceptable that the military intervenes in the democracy in such fashion.
General Staff is an organization that is ancillary to the government, and it is unthinkable that it makes statements against the government. The timing of the statement made by the General Staff is significant. It is conspicuous that the declaration took place during the process of the election of the 11th president. It can be conceived as an attempt to influence the judicial process, as the elections are now subject to judicial investigation.
The presidency is a highly symbolic position in Turkey, and the president is elected by the members of the parliament. The election has been a hot issue of debate because the ruling party did not choose a candidate that all parties in the parliament would agree upon. The result of that investigation might annul the results. However, many analysts and journalists say a decision for early election is necessary, no matter what the result of an investigation. But as Ahmet İnsel, a professor from Galatasaray University, points out, the election might even deepen the current crisis.
After the declaration of the military, it is obvious that the democracy is wounded. Now, any president that will be elected by the military. This wound can be healed only by early elections. However, with the authoritarian election law and the 10% election barrier, that makes the elections problematic too. Moreover, with the early elections, parliamentary elections will turn into a referendum about the presidency.
The memorandum is also significant in terms of the democratization process of Turkey, a country that has witnessed 3 coup d'etats and a forced removal of government by the military in the last 50 years. In terms of the European Union accession of Turkey, the European Council's Enlargement Commission expressed its concerns about the military's involvement in politics. The military is not only a party in the debate over secularism, but also in the debate on Turkish identity. The memorandum is as a result of the culmination of the tension between the traditional nationalistic factions in Turkey, including the military and the main opposition party CHP, and various groups such as the Kurdish DTP that question Turkish nationalism. There are many activist groups and unions that reject belonging to either of the parties. They oppose nationalist secularists and pro-Islamists. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ezgi Sertaş.
The death of five U.S. troops killed in Iraq over the weekend brings April's death toll past 100, making the month the deadliest for U.S. soldiers this year. A series of attacks throughout Iraq claimed the lives of at least 51 people Monday. And as FSRN's Hiba Dawood reports, for the first time in the history of the Shiite sect, Shiites are fighting Shiites and burning one another's mosques.
For 12 days, Basra residents have been calling for the resignation of Mohammed Musabbah, the governor of Basra. The demonstrators, all Shiites, have complained about the lack of local services, including electricity, cooking oil, and fuel. They presented their concerns to local lawmakers, but when the government failed to meet protesters' demands, they blocked key streets and bridges. When the demonstrators were determined the government meet their demands, the governor and his alliances wanted to silence them, say the residents of Basra. On Friday, two Shiite mosques were the target of attacks, the first one with a grenade on the Thar Allah Mosque, which translates to Revenge of God. It was named after the Shiite party based in Iran before the war, and is currently one of the Shiite parties participating in the strike. Another attack by gunmen carrying big guns also took place in another Shiite mosque affiliated with the Thar Allah party. Hassan al-Shumari is a member of the Fadila party, which holds 15 seats in the Iraqi parliament. According to al-Shumari, the attacks are part of a plan to oust the governor of Basra.
This is one of their lies. Thar Allah party members want to mess the situation up in Basra by sending the message that the Fadila party threatens and kills people and launches grenades on mosques. They want public opinion on their side so that they can find excuses for their bad actions in Basra. This is not unlikely to happen.
The mosques weren't the only targets. The building that housed the Fadila party headquarters in Basra was destroyed, but was fortunately empty when the grenade exploded inside. One resident of Basra, Safad Yab, says he's unsure who's to blame for the attacks.
We still don't know who has committed both attacks. We can't say who it was exactly, if it was a Shiite group or not. We don't know if it was because of the strike or for other political reasons. It is not clear to us. We feel that the fights are over the political challenges regarding the resignation of the governor.
The governor was unavailable for comment by airtime. It is still unclear whether he will resign to stave off potential confrontations between the Shiite groups in the south. People of Basra are watching the situation carefully, while the province council continues to discuss the possibility of al-Musabbah's resignation. It is still unclear if the government resigns, whom the central government will have to nominate to take his position. Safad Yab doesn't think al-Musabbah will step down from his position.
Four lists of different party representatives from the governorate council have decided they are going to vote for the resignation of the governor. There will be a session for the governorate council to vote on the governor resignation issue. Even if all the representatives who oppose the governor vote against him, there will be more from the same party who would support him.
In the meantime, the Iraqi parliament has devoted the next session to discuss the security situation in Basra and the necessity of sending security forces there. They will invite the governor of Basra and the province council members to discuss the issue with them. They will also send a delegation from the parliament to Basra to visit the city and closely study what is happening. For FSRN, I am Hiba Dawood.
Sunday marked the third anniversary of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. On April 28, 2004, CBS broadcast the first graphic photos of torture inside of Iraqi prisons on its 60 Minutes 2 program. FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports on what's changed and what hasn't in the Pentagon's prison policy over the last 3 years.
Americans did this to an Iraqi prisoner. The man was told to stand on a box with his head covered, with wires attached to his hands. He was told that if he fell off the box, he would be electrocuted.
As Dan Rather spoke, a slideshow of disturbing torture photos flashed across the screen. American soldiers posed naked with Iraqi prisoners. There were photos of naked Iraqis stacked in a pyramid, and in most of the photos, the soldiers were smiling. At the time, the Pentagon, represented by Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, said only a few bad apples engaged in torture.
What would I tell the people of Iraq? This is wrong. This is reprehensible, but this is not representative of the 150,000 soldiers that are over here.
The soldiers in the photos were prosecuted, and many received prison sentences. But no high-ranking officers or administration officials were put on trial. That didn't sit well with U.S. Army interrogator Tony Lagaranis. He came forward to say that torture was common practice in Iraq, and that he had himself tortured prisoners while stationed in Mosul in 2004.
We would bring in dogs, and they would be muzzled dogs, but the prisoner would be blindfolded, so he didn't realize the dog was muzzled. So we would try and terrify them, induce panic and fear, and keep them in stress positions, sleep deprivation, all these things in combination to break down the prisoner.
Subsequent reports indicate each of those interrogation policies was approved by then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Tony Lagaranis says his immediate superiors organized the torture he meted out.
My superiors had organized the dogs. They had organized the shipping container that we would use to maintain these prisoners in this state. And they just told us, this is what you're going to do for this guy. This is, you know, we've targeted this person for this, and that's what you're going to do. And we followed the orders.
After the photos were released, however, the military command structure changed its tactics. Joshua Castile is a former U.S. Army interrogator at Abu Ghraib. He arrived at the prison in June 2004, a few months after the scandal broke.
By the time I actually arrived to Abu Ghraib, every camera of the world was pointed at us. So things had changed radically. We were not allowed to touch people except for in acts of reassurance. It's like if we wanted to calm someone down, we might be able to touch their hand. But that was itself a touchy issue because you wouldn't necessarily know if what you did would be interpreted in the way that you meant it. So we were being watched by cameras and audio recording equipment, by visiting dignitaries on occasion. And so things were more or less structured around just talking in a room.
The main problem, Castile says, was that over 90% of the people he interrogated were innocent, simply caught up in large-scale military raids. Because the U.S. military rarely releases detainees, Castile says, he was forced to interrogate innocent prisoners again and again.
I was constantly being asked, tell me about freedom, about democracy, why am I being held here? I want answers. And the detainees were the ones who were wanting answers, but that was our job. We were supposed to be finding answers to our questions. But we kept on being put into positions that were incredibly puzzling because we were talking to people, we were trying to get blood from a turnip, more or less. And they were the ones who had the greater justification for the need to have answers.
The Washington Post reported this month the U.S. military now holds 18,000 security detainees in Iraq, almost double the number of Iraqis incarcerated when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke 3 years ago. The Post reports that number will soon pass 20,000, with more and more Iraqis apprehended in sweeps as part of George Bush's surge. Most of those detainees will be held indefinitely, will never be charged with any crime, and will not be allowed to see a lawyer. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
The mothers of Plaza de Mayo are commemorating the 30th anniversary of their movement today in Buenos Aires with a celebration of art and music. Thousands joined the mothers in the plaza to thank them for their three-decade-long struggle for human rights and justice. FSRN's Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
Por favor, ayúdennos! Ayúdennos, por favor! Son nuestra última esperanza!
In 1977, out of desperation and love for their children, a group of mothers began a protest to demand information about the whereabouts of their children. These youth were among the 30,000 people who were forcefully disappeared during the so-called Dirty War carried out by Argentina's military dictatorship between 1976 and 1983. While thousands were illegally detained in a network of clandestine detention centers, Jorge Rafael Videla, leader of the generals, steadfastly denied journalists' accusations of forced disappearances.
While a person has disappeared, they can't have special treatment. He or she is an unknown entity. He or she doesn't have an entity. They aren't present, neither dead or alive. The person has disappeared.
At a time when any protest was violently repressed, the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo broke the silence, themselves risking being disappeared. Rosa Camarotti, a mother who joined the protest in 1978 after her son was disappeared, recounts the March 24th military coup and how she first came to the Plaza de Mayo.
Del 24 de marzo del 76 te marcó a fuego.
March 24, 1976, marked us like fire. It was the tragedy of our lives. They took away our children, just imagine. But other things marked me as well. For example, when I approached the mothers, I truly felt supported by them. I felt the strength to fight because alone with my husband, we went around unable to find out anything without anyone knowing what we were doing.
On April 30, 1977, 14 women gathered in the Plaza de Mayo across from Argentina's presidential palace. At the time, the law prohibited groups of three or more people from gathering in public places. Yet these women began to walk around the pyramid in the center of the plaza. They identified themselves by wearing white headscarves symbolizing the diapers of their children. Juana Pargamant, now 92 years old, said that the mothers of Plaza de Mayo have always gathered the strength to fight from their children.
30 years of struggle. Of course we are older now. We started out when we were younger. When they took our children away, it was painful. We suffered. But we had a strength that I can't put into words. It was also a difficult lesson because we mothers had to learn to defend our children.
The mothers have endured physical attacks and endless threats over the years. Three of the founding members were disappeared and murdered in 1977 when the group was infiltrated by a military officer, Alfredo Astiz. Astiz, like many other former military leaders, has been charged with grave violations of human rights but has never been sentenced for his crimes. For Susana Diaz, a 76-year-old mother from the northern province of Tucumán, the most difficult times taught her the most.
We have to fight so that no other mother or father goes through what we went through. This is what we want, for them never to take away another child like they took away our sons and daughters, and for those guilty to be punished.
Only a handful of former military officers have been tried for human rights abuses during the military dictatorship. Last week, a federal court revoked a 1990 pardon for two of the leaders of the former dictatorship, Jorge Videla and Emilio Maceda, although it is unlikely that the former dictators will serve any part of the life sentences they received in 1985. According to Rosa Camarotti, the mothers would continue to fight until all ex-military leaders are convicted and put behind bars for their crimes against humanity.
To end impunity, all of the military officers, all of them, whatever their age, would have been put in regular jails. But that didn't happen. They were only imprisoned in their homes, living better than kings.
Despite legal obstacles, the mothers have said they will prepare a future generation to continue to defend human rights and demand justice. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support FSRN's programming, just visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Tina Gysi and Leanne Caldwell, sitting in for Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Abogado.